is the Church of Christ a cult? Now, I'll start this off by saying, and I hope this is not confusing to you, I am not asking, are we a cult? I'm asking the question, is the Church of Christ a cult? And somebody might ask, well, aren't we talking about us? I mean, it says on the sign out there, Church of Christ. Well, that depends upon, you know, whether or not we are the Church of Christ. Well, doesn't it say so on the sign out there? Well, that gives me an opportunity to say, just because the sign in front of somebody's building says they're a Church of Christ, that doesn't mean they are. They might be a cult. Okay, some groups that call themselves Churches of Christ might be a cult. I have cult-like characteristics. I'm not altogether sure. I'm really getting ahead of myself to start off this way. I'll explain this more fully. But just for right now, I'm not asking, are we a cult? I'm asking, is the Church of Christ a cult? And I'm going to be talking about the Church of Christ in as it's described in the New Testament. Is it a cult? Okay. But for a religious group to be labeled a cult creates a great prejudice, if not fear, in the minds of people toward it. Religious history has seen a lot of cults. And some of them in recent years have been very radical and even very deadly. Let me just give you a few examples. Some of you may be old enough to remember the People's Temple cult, and they created, they committed mass suicide, or maybe mass murder, in the nation of Guyana. What was it, back in the late 70s, early 80s? It was. And yes, they drank poison, and almost 1,000 of them, I think, were killed. Then you may remember, and this was back in the 90s, you may remember the Branch Davidian compound and the shootout there and the big fire that killed so many people out in Waco, Texas. Some of you may remember that. So you had the Branch Davidian cultist. And you may remember even, and I don't remember how long ago this was, this might go back to the 1990s too, but the Heaven's Gate cultists, they committed suicide in relatively large numbers too within this country. And then even more recently you might have heard about the Church of Scientology. It's been very interesting to me. I don't appreciate some of the language she uses, but Leah Remini, an actress who is a former Scientologist, has been doing some TV exposés on the Church of Scientology, and it is frightening what those people are capable of. So I'm just trying to give you some examples of what people might think of when they think of cults. And cults can be very dangerous, even deadly to some people. But going on, we have to ask ourselves, what is a cult? Well, what is it that makes a cult a cult? Let me give you the definition of one expert, and actually I will read his longer statement here. This is something of a précis of his statement. But one expert has said that a cult, quote, is any religious group which differs significantly in some one or more respects as to belief or practice from those religious groups which are regarded as the normative expressions of religion in our total culture. Now, that's a mouthful, and you may not have been able to follow that. But basically what he is saying, and this is my first problem with his definition, because this definition does have some problems. You might have heard the word normative. And he says that a cult differs, basically in its teachings and practices, from the normative expressions of religion in our total culture. Well, what is normal? What is the normative? Well, the word normative basically means let's just break it down to something simple here. Boiling it down means what the majority of people believe. It is what would be called the religious mainstream, in other words. Because the norm, who sets the norm? Well, what's normal is what most people do, right? So for all practical purposes, the normative is what the majority believes and does. Well, that definition has some problems with it. Okay? Because you can, oh, you're out of the mainstream, you're a member of a cult. And see, by labeling the people who are out of the mainstream cultists, then that creates a bias, a prejudice against them, and people don't even want to listen to what they might have to say. But let me remind you that, according to the scriptures, the majority can be and often have been wrong. Now, these scripture citations refer to some examples of the majority who were in the wrong at the time. In Genesis 6 through 9, which contains the story of the flood, the people before the flood, evidently in large numbers, were in the wrong. How many people were saved on the ark from the flood? Just 8 people. Noah and his wife, his 3 sons, and his 3 sons' wives. 8 people, that's all. Now, do you think that there were more than 16 people in the world at that time when the flood came? Well, if so, then Noah and his family were in the minority, but they were the ones who were right. So you can't just say, oh, you're a minority, therefore you are wrong for that very reason. No. Then in Genesis, the 19th chapter, we have the story of the destruction of the city of Sodom. Now, the only ones who came out of the city of Sodom were Lot and his wife. Of course, she was turned into a pillar of salt. And then their 2 daughters. 4 people got out of the city. So, I'd say that they probably had more than 8 people in the city of Sodom. So they were in the minority by far. Then remember the story of the 12 spies who were sent by Moses to spy out the land of Canaan. How many of them brought back a bad report? 10 out of 12. 10 out of 12. They were in the wrong. Okay? They were in the wrong. And then in the days of Elijah, when he was complaining about he alone was left, only he was faithful to the Lord. The Lord says, well, I've left 7,000 in Israel who have not bowed their knee to the false god Baal. Okay, 7,000, that sounds like a lot in absolute numbers. And it did show that Elijah was by no means alone in his faithfulness to God. At the same time, 7,000 out of the whole population of the nation of Israel, which might have numbered in the millions, probably a fraction of 1% had remained faithful to the Lord. Yes, the faithful were definitely in the minority, and those who were in the wrong were in the majority by far. Finally, Matthew 7, verses 13 and 14, we learn there that the majority are going to be lost. Jesus says there, enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and many are those who enter by it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and few are those who find it. So, the majority, according to what Jesus says, it seems are going to be lost. So, listen, it's not a good idea to define a cult as those who are simply not following the norm or simply out of the mainstream. Listen, there are some things I heartily believe that the scriptures teach. They're not in the religious mainstream at all. Just to give you a quick example, I don't believe that salvation is by faith alone. James, the second chapter, the end of the second chapter, denies that very specifically. But yet, evangelicals in large numbers believe that. So I'm definitely out of the mainstream as far as that is concerned. Does that make me a cultist? So, by the definition given by the gentleman I mentioned earlier, a religious group might pass in and out of cult status as the number of its adherents out of the whole population changes. Sometimes it might be in the minority, sometimes it might be in the majority. As a matter of fact, even the early church was a cult by this definition. And George read from Acts, the 24th chapter, in which The church is referred to as the sect of the Nazarenes. That was probably a way of the opponent putting down the church. Paul later on says, well, I'm part of a religious group which is called a sect. So he rejected the label sect, which is probably used interchangeably with the word cult. Probably what they meant, you know, a sect was something out of the mainstream. It's an offshoot. And it's a minority. And so basically what they meant by cult or by sect was what we would mean as a cult, at least by the definition of the gentleman that I mentioned earlier. But the church was considered in its day, in its early days, a cult. The church was considered radical, extremist in Jewish and Greek society, was considered to be threatening to the welfare of society. Let's just look at a few passages where that seems to be indicated. In the book of Acts beginning, when Paul came to Thessalonica with the gospel and started teaching and preaching the gospel, it created an uproar. The Thessalonians opposed what he was doing. It says in verse 7, and they're speaking, his opponents are speaking here, actually, verse 6. And when they could not find them, they began dragging Jason and some brethren before the city authorities, shouting, "These men who have upset the world have come here also." In the words of the King James Version, it's, "They've turned the world upside down." You see, the church was considered to be pretty radical at the beginning. And as a matter of fact, when Paul moved on to the city of Athens, it says that the Athenians, at least some of them, said that he seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities. So he was out of the mainstream to them. In 1 Peter, the 4th chapter, verse 4, finally, Peter speaks in this way about how Christians were looked upon by the people in their society. "And in all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them into the same excess of dissipation, and they malign you." They're surprised that you won't behave like they do. They think you ought to engage in the same excesses, like drunkenness and so forth, that they do. You see, Christians weren't doing the things that ordinary Greeks do. They were out of the mainstream. So it's a problem, really, for people to say, oh, a cult is just any minority group that is out of the mainstream of religious practice and belief. That's really an inadequate definition. And in the course of this lesson, shortly, as a matter of fact, I hope to bring what I think is a better description or definition of a cult to you. Well, also I'd like to observe, and this is important, this goes back to something I mentioned at the beginning of the lesson that might have confused you a bit. The name Church of Christ, and I have it in quotes here, might be used in a couple of different ways. It might be used in reference to any religious group which goes by that name. Whether or not that group truly belongs to Christ. Or secondly, it might be used in reference to the church which belongs to Christ and which is described in the New Testament. That's why I'm saying, when I ask the question which titles this lesson, "Is the Church of Christ a cult?" I'm not talking about us necessarily. Now that would be a second question we would have to ask and answer. Are we the Church of Christ? And somebody might say, "What do you mean, are you the Church of Christ? That's the name out on your sign out front." Well, does that really make us a church that belongs to Christ? No, it doesn't. We have to ask, well, are we truly living up to our name? And in order to answer that question, you've got to go to the New Testament and find out what the church is like, and see if we match that description. So, in the first instance, that is, that Church of Christ could refer to you know, a group that goes by that name, well, it might be a cult in that case. There, as a matter of fact, there are some groups that go by the name Church of Christ, or I think now in order to distinguish themselves, they might call themselves the International Church of Christ or International Churches of Christ. They do have some cult-like characteristics, and I have problems with them. But in the second instance, that the term phrase Church of Christ refers to the church that belongs to Christ and is described in the New Testament, well, then it doesn't really make any difference whether that Church of Christ is a cult, because it is the religious group of which all must be members if they want to enjoy God's salvation, because it's the church that is in the New Testament. Now, you want to call the church in the New Testament a cult? Well, as we've seen, by one very broad definition, not a very good definition, it would be a cult. But, you know, I'm not concerned about that. I'm concerned that I am a member of the Church of Christ mentioned, described in the New Testament. To call the New Testament church, which Jesus built, a cult does nothing to prove that its beliefs and practices are wrong. And therefore, the solution to this problem seems to be to determine and demonstrate what it is about a cult that is unbiblical, instead of simply depending on a label as an excuse to avoid the responsibility to examine a group and its teachings in the light of God's Word. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 21 says we're to examine everything carefully and hold fast to the truth. Now, to observe that a group diverges from the doctrinal mainstream serves no useful purpose to a person who is looking to be a member of the Church of the Lord. Let's consider then some characteristics of cults. Specifically, we might say some differences between the biblical church and cults. Now, I don't believe that the church we find described in the New Testament is really a cult. Its beliefs and practices are out of the mainstream. That's sure, but that's surely true. But what is that all a cult is? As I said, I think the definition given a while ago by that gentleman was really inadequate. Really, we need to describe a cult. What is a cult like? And do those characteristics fit the church in the New Testament? If they don't, then the church in the New Testament is not a cult. First of all, then, cults can often be identified with a founder or central authority figure other than Jesus Christ. You can trace their beginning back to a particular person other than Jesus Christ. Let me give you some examples. There are four or five what have been called major cults in American society. One of them has kind of died out and been replaced by another one. But there are four or five major cults, it is said, in American society. One is the Mormons, sometimes called the Latter-day Saints. I think they might prefer that reference. And you know, when I say they're a cult, I'm not trying to discredit them simply by calling them a cult. This is what others have grouped them. Okay, but it is true that the Mormons trace their founding back to Joseph Smith. Then you've got Jehovah's Witnesses. They trace their founding back to a fellow by the name of Charles Russell. Then you've got Christian Scientists. I'm not talking about scientists who are Christians, but there's a church by that name, Christian Scientists. Their mother church is up in Boston. They trace that church back to Mary Baker Eddy. Then you've got the Seventh-day Adventist. As a matter of fact, there's a Seventh-day Adventist school here in Piscataway. You may have heard of the Seventh-day Adventist. They trace their founding back to the teachings of Ellen G. White. Now, there's one other group that was called the Worldwide Church of God, and it was Herbert W. Armstrong's group. And he was an old man when I heard of him. He died some years ago, but he had started what was called the fifth major cult in American society, the Worldwide Church of God. It has since basically died out, gone through a transition, and walked away from his teachings, and I don't know what's happened to it, but it has essentially died out. As far as I know, you might say it's been replaced by the Church of Scientology. L. Ron Hubbard, you might have heard of L. Ron Hubbard, but here again, you can trace this cult, Scientology, or the Church of Scientology, back to one man. L. Ron Hubbard, who wrote out his beliefs or suggestions in the book called Dianetics, I believe. However, Jesus Christ is the one and only founder of His church. He said in Matthew 16, verse 18, it's recorded, I will build my church. He is described as the foundation of the church in 1 Corinthians 3, verse 11. Now, if people have to look to a single person as the one who began their way of religious thinking and teaching other than Jesus Christ, or they cannot imagine their group being in existence without that particular person, or they feel compelled to agree with what he says, then that person is accorded a place of importance and honor he does not deserve. We're warned in the Scriptures not to think more highly of ourselves than we ought to think, or to exalt anyone. For instance, among the Scriptures that I have up here to that effect, let's look in 1 Corinthians 4, verse 6. There it says, Now these things, brethren, I have figuratively applied to myself and Apollos for your sakes, that in us you might learn not to exceed what is written, in order that no one of you might become arrogant in behalf of one against the other. Don't become arrogant in behalf of one against the other, and exalt some among you. We're not to exalt men. Now, because of what I believe, sometimes I've been called a Campbellite. Okay? After a fellow back in the early 1800s, by the name of Alexander Campbell, and some people think he started the Church of Christ. Well, I'm here to tell you, I don't feel any pressure to conform to what Alexander Campbell taught. Now, some things I would agree with him about, but I would also have some serious disagreements with some of the things that he taught, to the point that, well, I would question his salvation. That's how serious my disagreements with him can be. So I don't have any problems disagreeing with Alexander Campbell. I'm not his follower. I'm a follower of Jesus Christ, and therefore I'm concerned with doing what Jesus says in His Word, not what Alexander Campbell might have written in his writings back in the 1800s. But to move on to a second point, cults often rely on extra-biblical literature or interpretations and teachings which are effectively made equal to the Bible. Now, three of the four major cults that I mentioned a while ago, actually I mentioned five, but I did say one of them, Worldwide Church of God, is I think, died out. So three of the four first ones that I mentioned, three of the four major cults in the United States, the Mormons, the Christian Scientists, Seventh-day Adventists, those three, claim inspired literature in addition to the Bible. Of course, most notably, the Mormons have the Book of Mormon. Okay, they think that is inspired. Jehovah's Witnesses, the fourth cult, do not formally claim inspiration for their literature, as far as I know. You've probably seen, it's been passed out, the Watchtower or Awake. Okay? They study those things in Kingdom Halls, which is what the meeting places of Jehovah's Witnesses are called. They study them, like, you know, they're the Bible, like their literature. Now, they may say, no, they're not that inspired, but practically speaking, they treat the literature that comes out of the upper echelons of the Jehovah's Witnesses organization. They treat that literature as if it was inspired. They don't feel, Jehovah's Witnesses do not feel free to disagree with it. Now, I have challenged Jehovah's Witnesses about their governing authorities. I've asked, do you think that they're inspired? And they may say no. The last Jehovah's Witness I asked that, he had to think about it for a while. He wasn't sure. That's understandable, because whether or not they deny that their governing authorities are inspired by God, they treat them as if they were. They don't feel free to disagree with them. You cannot disagree with your teachers if you're a Jehovah's Witness. You basically just take in and you know, spout what you hear. So, at the same time, while we may talk about cults in that way, there are very few of those who claim to be Christians who do not believe that God doesn't directly talk to them in some way. There are very few of those who claim to be Christians, in my experience, who will recognize that the Bible alone is sufficient for all of our knowledge of what God desires of us. 2 Timothy 3, verses 16 and 17 tells us that all Scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work. We don't need anything in addition to the Bible to know what God's will is and to go to heaven. Some people might say, well, you know, don't we need God to tell us if we should get up out of bed in the morning? Which job we should take? Where we need to go to college? You know, what house to buy? What car to buy? What clothing to purchase and so on? Other than in general terms, he doesn't address those questions. It's left up to us. But you see, cults, they believe you need to conform to what is taught to you in their writings. The third, cults often involve authoritarian, centralized control. What is remarkable about cults is the relative powerlessness of local congregations and their members. For instance, I was amazed some years ago to have found out that it doesn't matter which group of Jehovah's Witnesses you go to in all the world, all the Jehovah's Witnesses in their groups, in their kingdom halls on any particular Sunday, you're going to find that they're studying the same thing. Well, why? Because their management or their governing authorities, whatever name you want to give to them, tell them this is what everybody throughout the world has to study on this particular day. Has to be. That's amazing to me. That's control that shouldn't exist. You know, the Bible knows nothing of any kind of structure or hierarchy or government for Christians between the local church and its elders on one hand and Jesus Christ on the other. For congregational autonomy is contrary to cultism. Cults say, you do what the leaders say. We have control over everybody. Can you imagine if the churches over in Washington, New Jersey, or Fairlawn, New Jersey, or East Orange, New Jersey said, our leaders have decided that you at Piscataway, today you're going to be studying this or that. Today you're going to be talking about this or that. Are you going to be taught on this subject today? No question about it. That's what you have to do. I'd say, that's ridiculous. You have no authority whatsoever over us. Okay? But in cults, they don't understand what local autonomy or self-government means. Okay, but to move on to a fourth characteristic of cults. And this is related to what I've just said. Cults impose the opinions of the leadership on members, even in matters of opinion. The leaders of the cult make decisions for the adherents, even in minute personal matters. In various cults, I've heard this idea that, for instance, they will tell young men and women whom they can date and whom they cannot date. Now, I'll have to tell you, there have been a few times when I would like to say to a young man or a young lady in the church, you know, this individual looks like bad news, you know, not good character, you know, I've seen that. Don't date this person. I don't feel free to do that, though. That's a matter of opinion. And that's authority that God has not given to me. More frequently, there have been times when I have thought, you know, this individual, you know, not a good idea for you to marry this individual. This individual doesn't seem to be spiritual. And you want to go to heaven, don't you? You want to be a faithful Christian, don't you? I'm not sure that this individual is the right kind of individual to help you with that. But in the end, I can't tell that individual, member, what to do. I may give that member my opinion, but I cannot impose my opinion on that member. The leaders of the New Testament church did not attempt to dictate the personal choices of Christians beyond matters of faith and morals. Sometimes, as much as I would like to tell, to go back to the example I just gave, I like to tell a Christian, you know, don't marry this individual because he or she is not a Christian. I can't do that. Why? Well, because the Scriptures don't explicitly say that Christians cannot marry those who are not Christians. I cannot say that. And if the Scriptures don't say it, then I can't say it. Now, I may say, I think it's very bad judgment. I would not advise you to be doing this. And I may express that in more or less strong terms. But, you know, I can't impose my viewpoints on others. Not in that particular matter, anyway. Not beyond what the Scriptures themselves say. Let me give you an example of this. As a matter of fact, it does have to do with marriage. 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter. Paul deals with what is called the present distress. And in view of the present distress, he basically says, you know, well, this is in verse 26. It's basically not a good idea to get married. This is not a good time to be getting married. We don't know exactly the nature of the present distress that he was talking about, but whatever it was, it didn't make getting married a good thing to do at that time. He says in verse 26 specifically, I think then that this is good. Notice he says it is good. He doesn't say it's mandatory. He says, I think then that this is good in view of the present distress, that it is good for a man to remain as he is. That is, if he's married, remain married. If he's not married, then don't get married. To bring it down to an example, for instance, he even, beginning with verse 36, he even addressed fathers. This may sound a little bit strange to us in our society, but back then, in Paul's society, in Greek society, fathers literally had the power to tell daughters to marry or not. I mean, yeah, to marry or not to marry. Fathers literally had to give their permission. So Paul is addressing the fathers here, and the fathers will have a question. Is it a good idea for you to give your daughter in marriage or not? Notice how he expresses it finally in verse 38. So then, both he who gives his own virgin daughter in marriage does well, and he who does not give her in marriage will do better. So it's not a matter of what's sinful and what's not sinful, but what's good and what's even better. Okay? So we're talking about matters of opinion here. But notice Paul does not condemn people here for you know, acting contrary to what he says. Verse 36, beginning. Let's stick with this paragraph where he's addressing fathers of daughters who might be contemplating marriage. But if any man thinks that he is acting unbecomingly toward his virgin daughter, if she would be of full age, and if it must be so, let him do what he wishes. He does not sin, let her marry. But he who stands firm in his heart, being under no constraint, but has authority over his own will, and has decided that to keep his own virgin daughter, he will do well. Okay? So it's, he says, if you decide to give your daughter in marriage, you haven't sinned. Paul's not imposing his opinion on members. Let's drop down to verse 39 and 40, where he's talking about widows here, whether they should marry. He says, beginning in verse 39, a wife is bound as long as her husband lives, but if her husband is dead, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. But in my opinion, she is happier if she remains as she is, that is, in the state of widowhood, unmarried. And I think that I also have the Spirit of God. So, but he says, in my opinion, I think she'd be better off if she just didn't marry at all. But he's expressing his opinion. See, if a widow acts contrary to his opinion, goes ahead and marries, she hasn't sinned. Paul's just giving his advice here. My whole point is this. See, in a cult, they will impose their opinions on you. In the Lord's church, as we've just seen as an example from 1 Corinthians 7, Paul and other leaders in the church did not. Now, an opinion has been defined as that which is preferable but not provable. There may be some things I really, really, really prefer about you and in your conduct, but if I can't find it in the Scriptures, then I cannot prove that you have to do this from the Scriptures, then I cannot impose my opinion on you. And, of course, the Lord has taught Christians not to press their opinions on one another. First Romans, the 14th chapter, is based on that very idea. That we cannot impose our opinions on others. In cults, they do. Also, and I believe this is my last point, cults prejudice the minds of their members. This means that they instill in them the urge to make sure that their beliefs conform to what the leaders say. A cultist is not trained to think for himself. Independent thought is suppressed in cults. Sometimes I talk to brethren who disagree with me about various things. If it's not something that causes us to be unable to cooperate together in the work and worship of the church, then it becomes a problem. But a lot of disagreements I have with my brethren don't reach that level. So, despite our disagreements, we are able to work and worship together. Because we are taught that, you know, we can think independently. We might have disagreements among ourselves. But in cults, no. You're not allowed to disagree with the leaders. You know, there have been times when I might think, wouldn't it be nice if people never disagreed with me or criticized me? But then on the other hand, I have to back up and I have to think, now wait just a minute, we'd be in trouble, wouldn't it? If everything that came out of my mouth was never challenged. Sometimes I appreciate really the challenges of my brethren because it forces me to back up and rethink what I've said, restudy what I've said, and in some cases I have found out, well, you know what? I was wrong. But you see, when you can't ever disagree with what the leaders say, that sets up a situation where if they cannot be challenged, then they're basically going to think that they're infallible, and they're going to teach their adherents to treat them as if they are infallible. And you know what Jesus said? If the blind lead the blind, what's going to happen? Both of them are going to fall into the ditch. When one reaches the point where he can no longer entertain the possibility that he or his group is in error, then he is in the dangerous condition of not having an incentive to check his beliefs for error. See, I believe, theoretically, that I could be doing and teaching something wrong. Now, practically speaking, I may not believe that that's true, at least not on a large scale. But as I mentioned just a moment ago, or implied, you know, I have in some cases found out after years of doing something a particular way, or believing something a particular way, upon closer examination of the Scriptures, maybe as a result of being challenged by other brethren, I have found out that I was wrong. So I have to hold out the possibility that, you know, I can be wrong. I'm not infallible. And let me tell you, folks, if we ever get to the point where we think we're perfect and we're infallible, that the group of which we're members can never do anything wrong, we're in trouble. Because then we've lost our incentive to keep an eye on ourselves and our brethren. And you can see this kind of arrogance, and that's what it is, it's arrogance coming out in cultists in some cases. You know, one time, I think I might have mentioned this in earlier sermons at least once. One time, for instance, I was talking to some Jehovah's Witnesses, and I challenged them, you know, along these lines, do you believe that these governing authorities that you take your practices from, do you believe that they are inspired? Do you think they can make mistakes? Oh, yes, they can make mistakes. Give me an example. Whoa, when I got that specific, they had trouble coming up with examples. They had to reach back, I think, decades, at least in this one case, decades, to find an example of where their leaders had believed something that they eventually changed. You know what it was? It had to do with the shape of the cross. You see, Jehovah's Witnesses believe that the cross, instead of looking like a T as it traditionally was, is depicted, was just a stake, a pole in the ground. And this individual said, oh, they restudied that and they changed that. Well, how long ago? Well, that was back in the 1920s or something that they made that change. Really? That's all you can come up with? That was telling, I thought. But the Bible teaches humility. The need to study, not to think too highly of ourselves. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 12, it says, let the man who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. In 2 Timothy 2, verse 15, we're told to study, to show ourselves approved unto God, handling accurately the word of truth. We're to be careful. We're to be honest. Truth has nothing to fear from honest investigation. So these are the characteristics of a cult. I don't find those to characterize the church that I read about in the New Testament, as I've tried to show. Therefore, the church of Christ, that is, the church in the New Testament, is not a cult. Now, whether or not we are cult depends on whether or not we're conforming to the church that we see in the New Testament. None of the characteristics of a cult fits the church described in the New Testament. They should not fit the church of which a person is a member today. And if they do, then that person should leave that church if he finds that it has cult-like characteristics. The real question, this is what I started off with, is whether the church of Christ, such as we actually find represented in the world, us here today, for example, is a cult. But the even deeper question that we have to answer is whether that church is the church in the New Testament. And if it is the church of the New Testament, then as we've seen, the church, since the church in the New Testament doesn't have these cult-like characteristics I've given to you, then the church of which you're a member is not a cult. Are we the New Testament church? Have you done what it takes to be a member of the New Testament church? Which is another way, since the church is the body of the saved, in its simplest definition. What we're asking basically is, have you done what you need to do to be saved? If not, we urge you, as the Scriptures teach, it's not what I say, but as the Scriptures teach, we urge you to come forward in faith and in repentance, to confess before us your faith in Jesus of Nazareth as the Son of God, and then be baptized, immersed in a body of water that the blood of Christ might cleanse you of your sins. If you haven't done those things, I'm sorry to say the Scriptures teach that you're not a member of the church of Christ, the church that belongs to Christ. You might have done those things and since then have not lived as you should have lived. If that is the case, you might wish then to come before us and apprise us of the things you've done wrong in order that we might pray with you and encourage you henceforth to do what you evidently would desire to do, as shown by your coming forward, and that is to live as a Christian should live. We stand ready to help you as together we stand and sing.